Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, if it says GTCACGACAGG, then you shouldn't eat shrimp or nuts. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Folkebaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. That was a strange one. But today is going to be part two of a two-part episode we're doing on DNA. So last time, what did we talk about, y'all?
We talked about DNA a lot.
Yeah.
We talked about the history of humans knowing about DNA.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about what it is and what it does.
Where it might come from.
Where it may come from.
Yeah,
may or
sure.
Might.
Interesting research that we're learning about DNA in more recent years, and and in ways we can use it for medical purposes.
Yeah, and today we wanted to look at other ways we could use DNA as a technology, as a tool, and some of them are ways that you're probably familiar with if you've ever watched any like police procedural type stuff or anything like that. But we got a lot of other uses, including some pretty mind-blowing ones. Actually, I'd say all of these are mind-blowing because DNA, as an English literature major who hasn't had any kind of organic chemistry or biology courses in a very long time, this is all fascinating and terrifying to me. Because they're long molecules, man. You don't know what they're up to.
Do you have nightmares where you're just climbing down the infinite twisting ladder and you never reach the bottom?
I have nightmares where Mr. DNA is chasing me through the kitchen, and it's not Velociraptors.
And you're like, where do you come from?
Yeah, exactly. That's it. It's just Mr. DNA chasing me down an endless hallway over and over. Let's get on with the show.
All right. Okay, well, let's start with the present. We're going to get into some potential future technological uses of DNA, but what do we use DNA for today besides making our own bodies?
Well, it's honestly pretty pedestrian stuff. Okay, maybe not pedestrian. That's a dismissive word that belies the wonder and amazement of stuff like personal identification, okay? We can take a sample of stuff and tell who it came from.
Yeah.
That's pretty rad.
I like how you say stuff.
Well, I mean, you know, it can be a bone fragment. It can be some blood. It can be hair.
Could it possibly be pus?
Could be your eyeball.
Yeah, sure. And as we all know, like in forensics or paternity tests or historical studies of human remains, like Richard III or whatever that is, is that the guy that we found under a car park?
Yeah,
Richard III.
Excellent.
Dickie III, as we like to call him.
Just checking that I wasn't thinking about something else. Anyway, we can do all of those things with the DNA today, and it's probably the largest commercial field that we are using DNA as a tool in currently.
Mm-hmm.
Another upcoming one is DNA sequencing as a branch of consumer health. Because depending on what country you currently call home, you can either directly order or have a doctor order genetic tests. Tests that sequence your DNA either from a few specific genes or from your entire genome. And right now, mostly those tests are being used to tell you your likelihood of developing certain diseases, like a cancer or heart disease, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But in the future, this might be a commonly used way of helping people make all kinds of honestly pretty mundane lifestyle choices about like diet and exercise and sleep patterns and sun exposure and all kinds of stuff. That's a whole other episode, though.
Yeah, and it's also something that I know some doctors are a little skittish about because they're worried that people will go to private companies. In fact, this was one of the reasons that in America it's been a big issue.
The FDA regulating it, yeah.
Right, about going to a company and getting one of these sequences printed out for you to tell you like how likely are you to develop these things, because doctors are worried that people will start to make medical decisions without having a full understanding of what it is they're actually being presented with.
Oh, yeah, right. Because as we were talking about in the previous episode, DNA is complicated.
Yeah.
And genes are not, and we've said before on the show, genes are not on-off switches that necessarily lead to a particular thing. And it's really your entire genome together with a whole lot of environmental effects that determine what's going to happen in your body.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, caution is definitely necessitated, and it will be interesting to see where it goes, especially in this near future, this kind of like Wild West we're living in,
sure.
where we have more information than we know how to read.
Mm-hmm.
Another use for DNA, though, currently is creating recombinant DNA, which is a molecule of DNA that's been synthesized in a lab to include genetic information from more than one organism. And, you know, the idea being that the resulting organism will have beneficial properties or capabilities. And the most famous example of this is GMO crops, genetically modified organisms that are, you know, meant to be eaten mm-hmm. by us. And we did a couple episodes all about this back in July of 2013, I believe. But real briefly about GMOs, y'all, just because food has been genetically modified doesn't mean it's bad or dangerous or unhealthy.
Yeah. If you put fish genes in a tomato, it doesn't necessarily mean the tomato is going to taste fishy.
Yeah.
Nope.
Now, of course, that also doesn't mean that it's not possible to use genetically modified organisms in agriculture that might be environmentally unsound or something like that. But
oh, absolutely.
There's nothing inherently wrong with the process of modifying an organism's genes in a laboratory setting, because we do it outside a laboratory setting already all the time.
Right.
Constantly and unconsciously, yeah. Although that isn't the only use for recombinant DNA techniques. For example, you've got bioremediation, which is a long word that means that we can use organisms to clean up our messes, basically. So for example, researchers have engineered a kind of bacteria that eat harmful pollutants and excrete harmless byproducts.
Yeah, so this is like when you spill food on the floor and you let your dog lick it up, except instead of a dog, it's a whole lot of bacteria.
Yeah. And instead of food on your floor, it's an oil spill that's literally ruining the ecosystem of a very large area.
Yeah.
And putting adorable penguins in dire danger.
Mm. It's also World Penguin Day as we record this.
Is it?
It really is.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's DNA Day and World Penguin Day?
Same day.
They have to share.
Oh, fair enough.
Yeah.
I mean, penguins are sharers,
to be
right?
fair, though, it's National DNA Day, but World Penguin Day.
Oh.
Hold on. Let me blow your mind. Did you know that all penguins on Earth have DNA?
Except for one, and his name is Bruce.
Aw, Bruce. What are you doing, Bruce?
He's just a stuffed penguin. He's not real. All right. I'm sorry. We got off topic.
So yes, you can create bacteria that are like really efficient at degrading crude oil.
Mm.
And so you spray colonies of these suckers over an oil spill and they help clean the area up. There's been other projects where researchers created bacteria. There are bacteria that exist that break down TNT. Which I'm not going to say the full name for because I can't pronounce it. But it's that explosive. And, it's commonly used, for example, in landmines. And researchers added genes to this type of bacteria that make them glow when they break down TNT. So you add these suckers to soil in an area that you think might contain landmines, and then you can do like a helicopter survey and see if it's glowing.
Mm.
And if it is, you know that you know, A, don't go there right now. Don't walk around. And B, add more bacteria there and they can eventually process that TNT.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
It could work intuitively. I mean, in a war zone, you might naturally want to avoid fields that are glowing.
Right.
It's not actually no. Right now, whenever anything's glowing, I'm like, ooh, let me go over there.
Yeah.
I bet that has a health potion in it.
Whereas I'm just thinking, like, another rave. That's my
okay,
lifestyle.
Well, never mind. We'll use the helicopters.
All right.
Okay,
so
cool.
So let's talk about some other kind of cool emerging or possibly slightly futuristic uses of DNA. And the first one we wanted to talk about is one I can't wait to hear about because it's near and dear to my heart as the host of the Tech Stuff podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I really am curious to hear how DNA could be used as a diode.
Tiny diodes.
Yeah.
Tiny, tiny diodes.
A little rectifier. Okay, so in April of 2016, some researchers from the University of Georgia, right nearby here in Athens,
yeah.
and Ben-Gurion University in Israel published a paper in Nature Chemistry. And what this was describing how they were able to construct an electrical diode on a single molecule of DNA.
What?
And if the researchers claims in the press are correct, this would be the smallest diode ever constructed by humans. I don't know if anybody's disputing that. It seems legit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, anyway, it's the sort of thing that obviously you have to have the evidence to support it and everything, but why would you make such a claim if you didn't?
Oh, it's the smallest diode. Come on. What's a diode anyway? So a diode is an electrical component. You put it in a circuit and it allows unidirectional flow of current. Or actually, what you should say is the current flows in one direction very easily, but encounters massive resistance if it tries to flow the opposite direction.
Right.
And this can be used in a number of ways. For example, just one is as a fail-safe device, so as to prevent damage to equipment if the current in a circuit gets reversed.
Right. Yeah, it's absolutely imperative. Diodes are one of the most basic units in circuitry.
Yeah, and it's sort of similar to like a solenoid valve in a hose or in an engine kind of situation. Like when you have any kind of fluid that you want to go from one place to another, and definitely not go in the other direction.
Yeah.
So yes, good times there.
Exactly. Yeah. So one of the most basic elements of circuitry. You're probably really familiar with LEDs. Those are light emitting diodes.
Right.
They actually serve a purpose beyond just emitting light. They are also kind of like that one way street sign that says, mm-hmm, electricity go this way, don't go back the other way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so why is this relevant though?
Well, it actually has relevance to computing and to the potential termination of Moore's law, which we've talked about on this show before. So, brief refresher, Moore's law. It's the perhaps self-fulfilling prophecy of Gordon Moore that the number of transistors you can fit onto an integrated circuit doubles every 2 years or so, 18 months, 2 years, whatever. Yeah. And the practical takeaway is that affordable computer processing power follows an equivalent rate of evolution.
Right. So these days we wouldn't say that in 2 years' time we're going to fit twice as many discrete elements on an integrated circuit. It doesn't follow that pathway anymore. What instead we would tend to say is that the computers 2 years from now will be, or 18 months from now, will be twice as powerful. They'll be twice as fast.
Yeah.
That's kind of, Moore's law is one of those things where the definition of Moore's law changes
right. Every
few years or so. But the general,
it's not a law.
Right. It's not a law. It was originally an observation. Like you said, it had more to do with economics than actual computing power. The idea was that the ability to manufacture chips that would have more discrete elements on them was going to become economically feasible over time. So he was really saying that because of the scale of manufacturing involved and our ability to innovate, it will allow for what we then have as, you know, the doubling of processing power every 18 months. But we dumb it down a lot when we talk about it.
Yeah, our devices and our technoculture depend on this assumption. Hardware keeps getting faster.
Yeah. Otherwise you wouldn't have smartphones.
Yeah.
You couldn't. The device would not be large enough to compensate for the massive amount of processing power you need to do the stuff your smartphone can do.
You're right, but you might be thinking about this now, and you might be thinking, wait a second. So things keep getting smaller. Mm-hmm. You can fit more and more power into a dense area of what the computer processing unit is. Eventually, aren't you going to run into physics problems?
Oh,
well,
yes.
Yep. Eventually, you are going to reach the limits of what you can do on a reasonably sized silicon semiconductor chip.
Mm-hmm.
You run into basic physics and chemistry issues. So is there any way to keep packing electronics and computer power into smaller and smaller spaces? Could we have electronic components, including computing components, packed into a single molecule? Maybe. And DNA might be the answer, according to this study. So anyway, the lead author of the study, Bingquan Zhu, has pointed to, quote, the predictability, diversity, and programmability of DNA as attributes that make it sort of an ideal building material for nanoscale electronics, you know, electronics that are on the molecule level. They're tiny.
Mm-hmm.
So in this experiment in the paper I mentioned earlier, Zhu and his colleagues built a single duplex DNA molecule out of 11 base pairs, and then they inserted it into a tiny circuit. And then the team placed a molecule called coralline in between specific layers of the DNA coil. And with this, they were able to observe the DNA structure doing what a diode should do, meaning it allowed current to flow one way but not the other. Mm-hmm. Specifically, the current allowed in the circuit was 15 times stronger one way than it was the other. So they had built a DNA diode, or as I like to think of it, bingo, diode DNA.
Mr. DNA, are you going to chase me down that hallway again?
Anyway, so a quote...
Every night, Jonathan.
Oh, man.
A quote Zhu gave to the press, he said, our discovery can lead to progress in the design and construction of nanoscale electronics elements that are at least 1,000 times smaller than current components. Whew. So I think that's really interesting. What if one day we have, nanoscale electronics, tiny computing elements, computers that are built out of organic molecules and DNA?
And, I mean, obviously, like, if we're going to have armies of nanorobots, this is going to be part of it.
Yeah, very likely. I mean, you have to get to a point. If you have a robot that has its own ability to control its own motions as opposed to some sort of external force, because
mm-hmm.
most of the nanobots that we have talked about in previous episodes rely on some sort of external system manipulating their motion, like electromagnetic frequencies or ultrasonic frequencies.
Or some kind of chemical reaction to what's going on. Because, right. because the way that we've been designing them, obviously, the researchers say, we could never possibly have an energy source
right.
that
so,
small
so
or energy
small.
Control
yeah.
that small to be within something like that. So, yeah. Fascinating.
Very cool stuff. And I just love the idea that we could eventually have computers that could get a computer virus that could potentially be a real virus. One of the other things that we've talked about on this show before is the idea of programmable matter.
Yeah.
Yeah, the idea of having just stuff that you would then send some sort of command to, and it would take whatever shape or form – or not just form factor but function that you need it to do.
Yeah, and it's funny because one of the main inspirations for stuff like this is going to be organic matter like proteins. You know,
yeah.
proteins can fold and refold themselves to take on shapes that they need to do their functions.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have programmable matter, the matter should be able to maybe reshape itself or rearrange itself either by moving different components around or by changing the shape of the components to make different overall forms.
Right. The way that the basic molecule collagen is the stuff that makes your bones and your skin and structures in your eyeballs and all kinds of different tissues in your body. And it's the same basic protein, but it folds itself up into all kinds of different shapes. So,
Well, there's a group of researchers from Northwestern University who have been looking at using DNA along with gold nanoparticles to create different shapes. And it's kind of interesting how they're doing it. So what they're doing, they're essentially coating these gold nanoparticles with small strips of DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So you can think of it as but it's just one half of a DNA strand. So you imagine splitting that ladder down the middle. And you've got one half of the strand on these gold nanoparticles. By introducing them to the other half, the complementary half of that DNA strand, they can cause the gold nanoparticles to take all sorts of different crystalline shapes. So this is a very tiny, tiny version, this nano-sized version of this pluripotent material that we've talked about in the past. So it's not something that you would use to make a giant armchair. You're not going to have the golden throne for your Game of Thrones party. It's not going to happen. But it's possible that this sort of approach could lead to advances in optics. So, for example, when you're designing something, a lens, let's say, you want to be able to control exactly what kind of light can pass through that lens.
Uh-huh.
By shaping these crystalline structures at the right distance from one another, you can control for that. You can allow it to, or you can design such a way that it allows certain types of light, like certain colors of light, to pass through, but not others. Because you can be fine tune those spaces so well that certain wavelengths of light are the only ones allowed through. Which is really kind of fascinating when you think about it. And it creates all sorts of different possibilities, including stuff like advanced laser optics. So really an interesting idea, not necessarily something that we're going to see as a practical application in our daily lives. But when you talk about, you know, sort of this high-end tech approach, it's really an interesting possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, does anyone have anything that is a little bit more like ground level practical, something that could potentially change the way that we do live our lives?
Well, all right, we've talked in the past about how antibiotics are pretty amazing, but they're also something that we've depended upon so heavily that we may have shot ourselves in the foot a little bit. And by shot ourselves in the foot a little bit, I mean given rise to potential really dangerous bacteria that we cannot defend ourselves against because they are resistant to antibiotics.
We're creating the bacterial equivalent of doomsday, where you just continue destroying them over and over again until they become invincible.
Yeah, by foot we mean face, and by face we mean immune system.
Right, so in our Batman versus Superman versus bacterial infection, the bacterial infection's got a big leg up on everybody else right now. Because, like we said, it leads to this kind of super bug situation where you have bacteria that can infect a person and antibiotics will have no effect against them because the bacteria have already developed an immunity to that antibiotic. So one other approach we could use is using DNA to create viruses that target bacteria. So in other words, we make a bug to kill a bug. Though I have to remind you that viruses and bacteria are not the same thing, and they're not really – they're very dissimilar organically speaking. So the virus would insert viral DNA into the bacterial cell, and that viral DNA might do one of a couple of different things. It might shut down the bacteria's ability to resist antibiotics. So in other words, this could be like Obi-Wan sneaking in and turning off that tractor beam so the Millennium Falcon can escape, except in this case we're talking like more like a force field.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's more like Return of the Jedi, where they have to go to the forest moon of Endor and destroy the ground-based force field that's protecting the Death Star that is fully operational up mm-hmm. over in orbit. At any rate, I know I could
go into Star Wars.
Yeah.
So then you could do that, or it could even just kill the bacterial cell. Like, let's just bypass all that.
That's fine. Yeah, that's okay.
Or just render it harmless. So these are all the basic things that this viral genome could do if it were designed properly. As a bonus, that approach can be tailored so that it targets specific types of bacteria. Virus have protein markers on them that search for other specific protein markers, and they will ignore anything that doesn't fit that description, right? So it's almost like a cell-seeking missile in mm-hmm. a way. Well, if you design in such a way where it's looking for this harmful bacteria, it will leave all the helpful bacteria alone.
Oh, that's really great, because these days I'm sure that all y'all have experienced it. When you take an antibiotic, you wind up with kind of an upset stomach for a few days, because in addition to clearing out whatever infection you're trying to get rid of, that antibiotic is probably also destroying your microbiome, which is good for like digesting food.
Exactly. Right. So this would be potentially a gentler approach, and it would affect more dangerous bacterial strains. So it's a double win if we can make it work. But one of the other things I wanted to talk about, in fact, this was the basis of a video episode of Forward Thinking, and Lauren, you wrote the script, and it was phenomenal. It's just a really cool idea, is using DNA. I mean, DNA, it's all about holding information, right? It's information that makes us who we are. But we can use DNA to hold other types of information, too, and not just a little, a whole lot of information.
And the train of thought here is that, okay, we've got really amazing storage materials and technologies for data these days, but they have some downsides. And okay, so, you know, like we've got hard disk drives, which is, you know, probably what's in your laptop or your desktop computer, which work by magnetizing a ferromagnetic film on a disk, and the data is encoded in the changes in the direction of magnetism. Okay. Mm-hmm. If you remember floppy disks or like, you know, 5 1/4 inch floppies, anything like that, they used similar technology.
This is why it was so much fun to drag a magnet over somebody's floppy disk.
Oh, man, you were a mean middle schooler.
Yeah. I'm just kidding. I didn't actually do that. Come on.
Sure. No. Joe, you are truly the best of all of us. I didn't think that you would. Although now I wonder. I'll wonder every day. Anyway, that's also basically what makes magnetic tape work, like in cassette tapes or in not cassette tapes, because as it turns out, magnetic tape is not only used by kitschy hipster bands to sell their albums these days. It's actually the highest capacity type of memory available on the market because you can encode so much information into it. Mm-hmm. Then there's also flash memory, iterations of which are what's in your phone and your USB stick and like maybe your fancy silent running computer. And they work by the grace of wizards. No, I mean, probably not. But honestly, I understand them really poorly. Jonathan, fact check me on this. Basically, like a flash memory creates minute changes in voltage through transistors and then reads those minute changes in order to tell you stuff?
Yeah, that's one form of flash memory. But yes, you are correct. Which there are different types where some require constant power. And uh-huh. as soon as they lose power, then everything gets wiped. And then there are some that are persistent. Obviously, this would be more in the persistent realm because you're talking about things like thumb drives and stuff where you don't have a constant amount of
battery
current.
Attached. Yeah, sure. And then, of course, we have optical discs, CDs and DVDs and Blu-ray, which encode data in tiny pits and ridges. And then they scan those with a laser, and that's how you figure stuff out. So, yes, all rad, but downsides. First of all, they're pretty delicate. You don't want to jostle them around too much, or in the case of your optical discs, you don't want to, you know, scratch a huge key across them or something right. like that, because that will ruin them real fast. You don't want to get them too hot or too cold, mm-hmm. and the data in them will corrupt over time. Your hard drives, your flash drives, your burned CDs can all corrupt in as little as 5 years, and magnetic tape can corrupt in as little as 15 to 30 years. Also, even though they can carry an impressive amount of information, especially if you remember those 5 1/4 inch floppies and look at that in comparison to your cell phone mm-hmm. and think about how old you are, the technical limits of those materials aren't all that high when you start to consider how much data we're creating every day.
Right, which is an unbelievable, massive, huge, enormous... other adjectives amount of data. I mean, it's so big that it is impossible for me to get a handle on it. It is an amount so vast as to dwarf my sense of perspective every day.
It's a massive amount of spying they're doing on you.
That's the other problem, right? It's not just that we're creating a huge amount of data. We also need to make use of that data. And meanwhile, you have to put the data somewhere, and storage is a big thing. It's a big issue. You want a storage medium that's going to be safe and secure. You want it to be to last a nice long time. You want mm-hmm. it to be really efficient at storing a massive amount of data in a small amount of space. And like you're saying, Lauren, the options we have are limited, sometimes in multiple features all at once, you know?
Yeah.
So what's the solution?
Well, strangely enough, this episode is about DNA. So baby, hey, it's DNA.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. DNA can be used for data storage. It's hardy. Its half-life is like 500 years. So it can potentially store data for like centuries, and it can encode so much data, you guys. In the video episode that I wrote about it, I did a whole bunch of wacky math and, Okay, so DNA's theoretical limit is more than an exabyte of data per cubic millimeter. An exabyte is a billion gigabytes. A cubic millimeter is a fraction of a drop, like 2/10,000ths of a teaspoon.
So for an incredibly small physical volume, you can hold an enormous amount of digital information.
Yeah. In order to get that much information into magnetic tape, which is the densest storage medium available for purchase today, you'd need 100 million cubic millimeters of space, which is like 50 2-liter soda bottles.
Right. As opposed to the fraction of a drop.
Right. Optical disk storage at its theoretical limit would still require 5 2-liter soda bottles worth of space.
And again, since we're talking about creating this massive amount of information every single day, if you want to be able to store that information, particularly if you plan on doing something useful with it, like parsing through all that data because you're a nosy spy, you want to have the most compact, efficient means of data storage possible, because you're going to run out of space otherwise, or you're going to have to figure out, how long do I hold onto this data before I wipe it so I can hold on to the next batch of data because another enormous amount is coming tomorrow.
Yeah. So here's how the process works of encoding data into DNA. You get some computer scientists and some bioengineers. You get them in the same room together and you get them to design a system for encoding data in the nucleobases, the nucleotides of DNA. And these building blocks can basically be used like ones and zeros. Or, you know, since there's four blocks, you could use base four instead of binary, which is the approach that a team out of the University of Washington in collaboration with Microsoft Research chose recently. The bioengineers can synthesize DNA, sticking the nucleotides together in a sequence in order to encode your data. This recent team even included little ID tags in the DNA sequences in order to make the data random access. Like your hard drive is random access, which means that you have like a whole soup of information kind of like stuck on there, but you can pull out whatever bit of information you want at any time. And so here you can have a whole vial of DNA and you can still find whatever bit you need quickly.
Right. Instead of having to read through the entire amount of data that has been encoded in that string, you can zone in on the specific string that is relevant to whatever it is you need, which is incredibly important, right? It's kind of like anyone who's played just a video game where you're playing something where it's reading from memory, that stuff is very responsive. And then you move into a new area where it has to consult the
read off of the disk.
Right. Then it slows everything down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's very important that we have this random access memory approach, because otherwise if you had this massive amount of data stored, it would still be very frustrating if it took you, you know, 2 days to find the specific part of the information you needed because it was buried so far deep in that DNA strand.
Right. That is less useful,
yeah,
scientifically speaking. Right, because in order to read the data that's written in your DNA, you just sequence the DNA and then decode the data.
Mm-hmm.
And the downsides here are that it's currently so expensive to synthesize and sequence DNA, and also it takes time, like at least 10 hours to sequence your DNA so that you can get your data out of it. But this recent team thinks that it could so easily be made cheaper and faster, especially, you know, if there's a financial incentive to do so, you know, which there is, and not only for data storage, as we discussed in the previous episode.
All right, so we've talked about DNA being used as diodes. We've talked about DNA being used to target bacterial infections, DNA being used for data storage.
DNA being used as a beverage.
DNA chasing me down an endless hallway. What other uses could we see DNA applied toward in the future?
Well, here's one that I think is pretty interesting. So we've talked before about building organs in the lab, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
There are multiple ways you can look at this. You can look at like the organ on a chip concept,
mm-hmm,
or you can just talk about building organs actually as in like 3D printing organs,
mm-hmm,
that would eventually be used as donor organs. We're not quite fully there yet, but we're making headway with a lot of this technology. And it's useful for lots of reasons. Like one of the big ones is harm-free research. You can test the effects of a drug or study the progression of a disease on a living organ without actually damaging a living person. So assembling these lab organs, it shouldn't be impossible, right? Because it happens in nature. The cells in your body can do it. They can divide and self-assemble into a kidney or a liver. So why shouldn't they be able to do the same thing in a controlled laboratory environment? They should. It's just not very easy at all.
Mm.
And so one of the things that we try to do is what we just mentioned, 3D printing an organ, like 3D printing in a lab environment, depositing cells upon one another to eventually spit out a whole organ. But that's not as easy as it sounds. You encounter multiple problems. One of them is it's hard to get the cells to stick in the right place. Number two is it's hard to print with enough precision. Ideally, what we'd want is single cell resolution, you know, upping the resolution on your printer.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, it would be upping the resolution until you print one cell at a time, and that's not easy to do.
Yep. Cells are small.
Right.
They're not big.
And then on top of that, it's hard to keep cells from being damaged or killed in the printing process.
Right, because if you just end up with a bunch of dead cells in your brand new organ, you don't have a very useful organ.
Right.
It depends on what you want it for.
Yeah. Right. Well, we are not shooting the next episode of Game of Thrones, so we don't have a need for viscera just to throw around everywhere.
But interestingly, DNA plays a role other than encoding the building blocks to make cells in a solution that was proposed in a paper called Programmed Synthesis of Three-Dimensional Tissues in Nature Methods in 2015. And in this paper, the authors describe a method of constructing 3D, quote, organoid-like structures using the help of a kind of DNA Velcro that allows DNA-coated cell structures to stick to gel-coated surfaces and to each other. And the method they have is called DNA Programmed Assembly of Cells, or DPAC. And it goes like this. Mm-hmm. The cells for creating the organoid structure get pieces of single-stranded DNA inserted into their outer membrane. So you got a cell, and you stick these little DNA hairs all over the outside of it.
Mm-hmm.
So this means the cells are coated in DNA molecules that act sort of like code-locked Velcro.
Mm-hmm.
They'll stick to DNA strands on the outside of other cells, but only the ones that have the right code sequences
right.
and lock up with
Ooh.
Them.
The complementary.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So what you can make with this is cells that are coded to stick to exactly the other cells you want them to and not stick where you don't want them to.
That's very clever.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And so hopefully what they're saying is that this will help us build these organoid structures in the lab that'll eventually aid in things like tissue-specific cancer research.
Ooh, yeah.
I just like the word organoid.
Yeah.
It makes me think of like it's like some sort of He-Man villain. But I have one last future use of DNA that's pretty hot.
Yeah,
you guys are gonna like it.
How hot is it?
Like more than 100 degrees Celsius hot, so hot enough to boil water. So yeah, I'm talking about using DNA in a method that would allow engineers to build better facilities to harvest geothermal energy and convert it into electricity. And you think, how could DNA do that? I was really confused when I started reading the article because I was thinking, I don't see where DNA comes into here at all.
Where's the connection?
Yeah, so here's the connection. Here's what the scientists were working with. A scientist or grad student, Yuren Zhang, energy researcher, Stanford grad student, was talking about using nanotracers.
Grad students can be scientists, but nanotracers,
yes. Yes, yes. Well, grad student because not fully outside
graduated,
of graduate school yet, but still has this idea about nanotracers used for geothermal surveying. So what he did was he took nanotracers, and nanotracers you can just think of as it's a substance that you're pumping into a geothermal reservoir to kind of see where it's connected to other wells, geothermal wells in the area. If you have nanotracers popping out of one well, you're pumping them into another well, you say, oh, these two are connected.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that if you have a pretty complex geothermal reservoir system, you can't really be sure if you're injecting nanotracers in multiple locations, which nanotracers belong to which pump sites, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're injecting them in at like five different sites and you're getting nanotracers out of a well, unless there's some way to identify those nanotracers, you cannot be certain that they came from a specific injection site. Thus, you can't really say, we've mapped this out and we know that these two points are connected. It might be one of the other points that are connected. But DNA could help solve that problem. So what the researchers are suggesting is that you should encode the nanotracers with DNA and give them like a little name tag, an identifier, so you know these nanotracers specifically belong to this injection site because it has this specific DNA sequence encoded in the nanotracer. That would allow the researchers to create a more accurate geothermal map and help engineers decide the appropriate place to set up a facility or to inject water into the reservoir to break up rocks to get better access to geothermal energy.
Huh.
And in some of their experiments, you know, they haven't put this to practical use. They've done it in the lab to make sure that this would actually work. They used some sand and they heated the sand to see if they used strands of DNA, if the strands could hold up under the conditions that they would encounter out in the field. They saw that the DNA could remain intact after encountering temperatures as high as 302 degrees Fahrenheit, or 150 degrees Celsius, which would be similar to what they would encounter if you were actually pumping them into these geothermal reservoirs. So it's kind of interesting. They don't directly allow you to convert geothermal energy into electricity.
No.
But they give more tools to the people who want to tap into that power and convert it into electricity. And according to the researchers, they anticipate that with a conservative estimate, they said, that in the future we will rely on geothermal energy to provide 5% of the world's electricity, which sounds like a small amount until you start to actually look at numbers and see how much 5% accounts for. And it's enormous. So, and of course, every bit you can take away from fossil fuels is a big help in other areas.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And it's so fascinating. I love these approaches that people are using to take DNA and use it as an actual tool. I mean, we are man the tool maker, but it's so great that we're taking this tiny thing that makes up our cells that we only really started to get a handle on within the past century, and we're bending it to our own power.
Well, I mean, it's sort of the most fundamental level you can go to when you're talking about biomimetics, right? Well, maybe not, actually. You could probably go to proteins, maybe, which would be even simpler. But I mean, when you're talking about making technology or machines based off of principles that we see employed in nature, these are the most fundamental machines out there. They're the machines that make all the other machines.
Right. I don't think when Friedrich Miescher was looking at all that pus, he was thinking, you know, I bet someday we're going to store information in the stuff that's in this stuff that I don't even know the name for yet. I bet he wasn't thinking that. And I bet if we took the Wayback Machine, we'd prove ourselves right. But we've run out of time.
I wanted to go back to the pus party so badly.
Even the Wayback Machine, it's still recharging from our last jaunt. So we're not going to be jumping in there anytime soon.
Well, this has been a fun journey to go on with you guys.
It has been fun.
With the DNA molecule and with pus.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's been educational, I will say. Now, it's been really fascinating, and who knows what other potential applications we will find for DNA in the future. And of course, there are all the other ones that we've talked about in previous episodes, things like, genetic medicine, that sort of stuff. The really looking at how we can use tools like CRISPR in order to manipulate genes so that we can improve our health or perhaps even enhance ourselves in some ways, which of course is a totally separate subject that has its own massive ball of ethical concerns attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
But all of it is coming back to this long chain molecule and really fascinating stuff. So guys, if you have any questions about DNA, that's how I'm going to say it from now on. Thank you, Joe. Then you should write us and send those questions. Or if you have any suggestions for future episodes, you've got an idea, you want to know how X will work in the future, or maybe there's some emerging technology you want to hear more about, write us. Let us know. Our email address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. Or drop us a line on Twitter or Facebook. At Twitter, we are FWThinking. Just search FWThinking in Facebook's search bar. We'll pop right up. You can leave us a message there. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.